This investigation is taking a two-pronged approach. Best of both worlds, you might say. What we're doing here is using some local ingenuity to follow the magic. That's one prong. The other is a method we use where I come from called following the money. White smoke started rising from where Jason had just sprinkled water. "That's our first hit," Jason said. Jason took out a metal stake with a bright red ribbon tied to it and shoved it into the ground. Then he went back to moving through his grid pattern, sprinkling more water. "There isn't a lot of business regulation locally," Jason said. "That's what happens when the people who make the rules are the ones who own the businesses. When I took this contract, however, I discovered the lumber industry is a notable exception. The industry and its attendant land rights are very regulated."
"That's why I'm in danger of losing my land," Kyle said. "There are production requirements for landholders, and we haven't been producing since this monster started showing up."
"Well, good news," Jason said. "Since investigation here seems to consist of finding the first guy that can throw fireballs and asking him to take a look, no one seems to have invented shell companies. I found where all the records were kept, spent a few hours to poke around, and found everything I needed, with a little help from a bribed official."
"You bribed a city official?"
"Not to do anything illegal," Jason said. "Just to help me navigate a less than helpful record system. That's how I know who's behind all this and why."
"You already know?"
"Yep," Jason said. "Now I just need some corroborating evidence, by which I mean whoever they're actually paying to come out here and summon the monster. I get that person to talk, and we can get you back up and running."
"You think they will?"
"Maybe," Jason said. "Even if they don't, we'll get something we can use." Jason searched out his whole grid, putting down a stake each time Jory's water potion mix found high salt content. When he was done, Jason took stock. His stakes, with the eye-catching ribbons, were clustered in a small area. "About what I thought," he said. "I checked the whole area to make sure, but it looks like our summoner comes out here and summons his monster in more or less the same spot every time. Then he has it wander about until you see it. I take it you never chased the creature?"
"A huge aggressive monster?" Kyle asked. "No, I didn't."
"Eminently sensible. When was the last time you saw it?"
5 days ago?"
"Probably too long to track it from the last summoning," Jason said. "I'll give it a go, though." Jason conducted the ritual Clive had given him at each of the summoning sites he had found. Ghostly images of a bear-like creature appeared briefly, but there wasn't enough residual magic to imprint the summoner's aura on a tracking stone. "Yeah," Jason said, as he kicked the salt he used for the circles into the dirt. "We're going to need a fresh monster sighting."
"That last appearance was less than a week ago," Kyle said. "That could be some weight."
"No worries, Kyle," Jason said. "I've already laid some groundwork." Jason returned to the inn as the sun ducked below the horizon, unhappier than when he left that morning.
"Food and drink, same as before," he demanded of the barman.
"I'm out of here at first light. I'm not staying a moment longer than I have to."
"No luck?"
the barman asked. "It's not a matter of luck when some idiot is making things up," Jason said bitterly.
"I swear, if one more report comes in from Lindover, I'm not coming back. I'll have him blackmarked on the spot and let the damn bureaucrats sort it out."
As promised, Jason departed at first light down the road to Greenstone. He passed through the next town as well to make sure before he cut back cross-country to the Lindover property. The trees made stealth easy on the occasions he saw workers on the properties he passed through. It was 3 days before the Fergax appeared. With his aura fully restrained, he followed it with a recording crystal active as it roamed around for several hours. Kyle came out and spotted it, running when it roared at him. But it didn't give chase. It didn't do anything but roam about until it vanished when the summoning duration expired. All the while, Jason quietly stayed out of its path, watching it as the image was captured by the recording crystal floating over his head.
"The problem is we have bears around here," Kyle said, as he and Jason looked at the tracks left behind by the Fergax. "Sometimes they get curious and come in close, and their tracks are pretty much identical. Some of the other adventurers that came out thought I was seeing bears and getting rattled."
Well, we have the recording now, so at least we can demonstrate there really is a monster, Jason assured him. That means a black mark is off the table, at the very least. Next, we see if we can't do a little better than that. Using the watering can, Jason found a large salt reaction and performed the tracking ritual. This time, an aura imprint found its way onto his prepared tracking stone. As expected, it led him straight in the direction of the neighboring Clemenson property, which Jason had anticipated before ever arriving. It was laid out much the same as the Lindover property, but was in full operation. There were workers everywhere, and the magically driven saws could be heard loudly cutting into wood in the mill. The other big difference was the farmhouse. The Lindover farmhouse was large but functional. On the Clemenson property, the farmhouse was both larger and more ostentatious. Jason didn't bother to hide, striding through the property as if he owned the place. He got a few glances from workers, but the combat robes and the weapons said adventurer, which no one wanted to mess with. A man came out to meet him, and was forced to follow along as Jason didn't slow, letting the tracking stone lead him to his quarry. Where the lumber workers had practical attire like Kyle, this man wore city fashions.
"If you don't mind me asking," the man said, "what brings you to my property?"
"Monster hunt," Jason said, without so much looking at the man. "You're Clemenson?"
"Eustace Clemenson, yes, sir. You think there's a monster on the property?"
"I'm sure you're familiar with the troubles your neighbour is having," Jason said. "A monster appeared there several hours ago, and I've been tracking it to the source."
"Tracking it?"
Clemenson asked, unable to hide the panic in his voice. It might have been at the idea of a monster on his property, but Jason didn't think so. "I managed to get an aura imprint. That imprint led me directly to your property." Clemenson was starting to sweat, his eyes darting nervously in the direction Jason was heading.
"You've obviously been working hard," Clemenson said. "Why don't you let me offer you some hospitality? You can have some refreshment and I can tell you about the property. It might help you find what you're looking for."
"This tracking stone is all the help I need," Jason said, continuing his rapid stride.
"I'll leave you to your business then,"
Clemenson said, and started moving ahead of Jason at a half run.
"Stop,"
Jason ordered. His aura came down hard on Clemenson, who staggered and stopped.
"Sir?"
he asked, feebly. "I think it would be best if you stayed with me," Jason said.
"For safety."
Withering under the force of Jason's aura, Clemenson reluctantly nodded, falling in behind Jason as he resumed his path through the property. They quickly came on a building detached from the main residence, made from stone and an indulgent amount of wood. On a porch swing, a man was sitting up, rubbing his eyes, as if just having woken up. He gave the approaching pair a bleary-eyed look, focusing on Clemenson.
"Eustace," he said. "What was that aura? I just..."
The man trailed off as he realized the source of the aura was standing next to Clemenson. Then his gaze locked onto Jason's face, and his eyes went wide. Chapter 94 Consequences. The Temple of the Healer in Greenstone was one of the central temples on the Divine Square. Inside, a man named Neil Devone was making a stand.
"I won't be a part of this," he declared to the chief priest. "This isn't about serving the healer. I spend my days following around the most petty noble in Greenstone, so I know what power and ambition look like."
The chief priest had all the temple clergy arrayed behind him, ready to move out. He looked at Neil with a dismissive sneer.
"Be thankful that your powers come not from our God, for he would take them from you. If you would stand against us, then you are no longer welcome in this church. Be gone from this place and never return."
Neil steeled himself, his expression hard. He turned around and strode out of the temple. On the Clemenson property, Jason was confronting the man the tracking stone had led him to.
"Asano,"
the man uttered. Jason frowned. He recognized the face from somewhere, but couldn't place it at first. Then revelation struck.
You're one of the people that attacked me in Old City.
I didn't attack you,
the man said quickly, his voice rising in pitch.
That was Denk. We all left, just like you said.
And now you're here summoning monsters, Jason said. Stay where you are, Mr. Clemenson. Clemenson had been slinking away while Jason's focus was on the other adventurer, but stopped short at Jason's command. He looked back and saw that Jason hadn't turned to look.
Yes, Mr. Clemenson, Jason said, without taking his eyes off the man in the other direction. I am watching you.
Jason had Clemenson under the strict watch of his aura sense, the normal rank mill owner having no way to hide it. He kept his eyes locked on the iron ranker.
Don't know anything about summoning any monsters, the man said.
If you don't want to tell me things, then don't tell me, Jason said. Lying is just going to make things worse. The man looked up at the crystal floating over Jason's head.
Is that a recording crystal?
It is, Jason said. Why don't you tell me your name?
Why?
Jason's hard expression broke into a chuckle.
Well, if nothing else, Jason said, it can't be worse than what I'm calling you in my head.
What's your name?
Tuckle,
the adventurer said warily.
Dean Tuckle.
Jason gave him a sympathetic smile, his body language shifting from harsh confrontation to loose and relaxed. Jason casually strolled up to the porch, where the man had been napping on a long swinging chair. The man tensed at Jason's approach, giving a startled jerk as Jason casually plonked himself down next to the man on the long chair.
Nice to meet you, Dean. I'm Jason.
But you knew that. Jason looked out from the porch. The back building didn't look out over the lumber mill, but instead at the crops grown to feed the workers.
This isn't bad, Jason said, taking it all in. If I recall correctly, Dean, you were the one that tried to talk Dink out of attacking me. Is Dink his real name?
That's his nickname,
Dean said hesitantly, wary of the man sitting next to him.
His real name is Jared.
I'd definitely take that over Dink, Jason said.
Was he the one who picked Dink?
Yeah.
Clearly some people are beyond help.
All right, Dean. This is quite a pickle you've got yourself in. The way I see it, things are going to go one of four ways from here. I'm just going to come out and tell you that I know what you're doing, who you're doing it for, and why.
Don't listen to him,
Clemenson said, from where he was still standing in front of the porch.
He's just trying to get information out of you.
Jason turned his gaze unhappily to Clemenson.
That's quite enough out of you, Mr. Clemenson, Jason said. If you're going to be a nuisance, then you may as well run along after all.
The mill owner required no further encouragement, scuttling away as quick as he could.
Now, Jason said.
Where were we?
Right. I was just explaining that I already know everything.
Do you, though? It sounds like Mr. Clemenson is right, and you just want me to talk.
Oh, I certainly do. But want isn't the same as need. This is more about tying things up neatly than me requiring anything from you, Dean. Let's go through the four ways I see the situation potentially playing out. In scenario one, which is my personal favorite, and I hope will be yours as well, you tell me everything. That gives me what I need to make sure this all gets handled quietly and without too much of a fuss.
Are you a member of the Adventure Society, Dean?
Dean nodded.
All right. Then you definitely want to talk to me. With your cooperation and me putting in a good word, then you shouldn't expect more than a slap on the wrist. It lets me settle everything nice and quiet, and the Mercers don't have to dump all the blame on you when everything goes public.
Dean started when Jason said the name Mercer, and Jason felt the hook set in. Dean, this is an opportunity for you. A chance to get out of doing shady jobs for other people and stand on your own as an adventurer. My guess, and what will be my recommendation, is that you get put on a road contract. A bit of travel, helping some people who need it. Most importantly, it gets you out from under everything while the situation gets settled. Then you can come back, having proven that you can do your job. Dean looked uncertain.
You don't do a lot of monster fighting, do you, Dean?
Dean shook his head.
That's all right, Jason said. On a road contract, you'll have people to back you up.
Wouldn't you rather have someone better than Dink watching your back?
You have all the tools you need to make it in life, Dean. You don't have to be the greatest adventurer in the world. You can live a good life just being an okay one.
Jason kept his own expression under control as Dean looked thoughtful.
That's scenario one, Jason said.
They gradually get worse from here?
In scenario two, you keep your mouth shut, but don't make a fuss. I don't know all the details, so things get messy as what I do know starts loudly clashing with what I don't. The Mercer name gets loudly bandied about, and not in a good way.
They'll be fine, of course,
but I don't think you're the one they'll be looking to protect in this situation, do you?
Especially given that they'll need someone to push all the blame onto.
Best guess, they'll come down on claiming the whole plot was you and Clemenson.
Jason knew that Dean didn't even realize he was nodding as he thought it over.
That's how things go if I just walk away now. Scenario three is where you kill me to keep everything covered up, but that's a rough one. I have friends and connections that will be out here going over everything. It won't just be me you have to get rid of. Clemenson, everyone on the property who saw me head in this direction, Lindover, a few people in Loose, even. Or you could run.
But where are you going to go?
Greenstone's out, probably the Delta too. Are you going to go out to one of the desert towns, the Veldt? You have a full set of essences, so you can make a life for yourself out there. If my friends don't find you.
Jason slapped Dean on the back.
All of that assumes you could even kill me, which I think we both know is a sketchy proposition at best. I'm fully armed and equipped for combat. Here, you're armed and equipped for a relaxing nap. Scenario four is that you try to kill me and fail.
I don't need to explain the consequences of that one, do I?
Jason sat back in the chair.
It's all up to you, Dean. Except for the one where you kill me, my contract gets completed whichever way we go.
The first scenario works out best for both of us, but I can live with any of the ones where I, you know, live.
Dean looked at Jason, reclining comfortably as if he didn't have a care in the world. He spent a long time thinking in silence as Jason quietly waited.
All right, Dean said. It was Thadwick Mercer. He set all this up.
Just Thadwick?
Yeah. He's been pulling in some of the less successful adventurers over the last year. He even pulled some strings to get some of us an easy ride through the assessment.
You?
No, Dean said. I didn't do all that well, but I got through on my own. But it shook me, you know? Putting your life on the line. It's not easy for adventurers who don't want to fight monsters. People look down on you, you know? We come from decent enough families, so working under someone like Mercer is better than working for some crime lord or gang boss. At least, that's what I thought.
Oh?
That thing where Mercer sent us after you, kicking the crap out of you and recording it. How is that any different from working for a criminal?
Thadwick sent you after me?
Dean nodded.
He knew about the contract you'd been assigned and that you were meeting a contract in the townhouse. We just had to hang around, waiting for you to pass through.
Jason sighed. Using and abusing Thadwick had been a mistake from the beginning, and now he was paying for it.
What about this whole thing? Jason asked, gesturing around them. The land grab deal.
I don't know what it's about, Dean said. Every couple of weeks I was told to come out here and spook Lindover with my summon. Then I lay low here in Clemenson's guest house and quietly go back a few days later. A couple of days ago I was told to get out here and do it again, and he said it was probably the last time.
And by he, you mean?
Thadwick Mercer. It was all him. He's always going on about how this is all his deal, how he'll show his father what he's really capable of.
Jason sat up straight and took a deep breath. All right, Dean, you did well. We're going to Greenstone to get this all settled. I said I'd look out for you, and I will. Jason stood up, then held out a hand for Dean to shake.
Are you ready to stand on your own feet, Dean?
Dean stood up and shook Jason's hand, looking like a weight had been lifted off him.
You know what? I think I am. There's something you should know, though.
Oh?
I didn't come here by myself. One of Thadwick's other people came with me. I don't think he'll let us leave quietly.
You've got that right.
Both men turned in the direction of the intruding voice. A burly human was storming in their direction, Clemenson following behind.
Looks like I have to put both of you down,
the burly man said. Not going to happen, Jason said as darkness manifested around him, speckled with stars. Dean, you'll want to stay out of this. Neil Devone rushed down Broad Street Boulevard. There was a crowd gathering outside the newly refurbished Broad Street Clinic, which was about to have a grand reopening. Neil pushed his way through the crowd and rushed up to the doors, made of reinforced, magic-wrought glass. They were designed to open and close themselves, but the clinic was not yet open, and they remained shut. Neil started hammering on one of them with a fist.
"Friend, they'll be open soon," an older man assured him. "Just be a little patient."
The man chortled to himself.
"Patient," he said. "That's funny."
Neil ignored him and kept hammering away until a young woman appeared on the other side of the glass.
"Sir," she said loudly through the glass, "if you can't wait quietly for the clinic to open, then you will be turned away when it does."
"I need to see Jory Tullman," Neil yelled. "I need to see him right now."
The woman looked Neil over. Compared to the bulk of the crowd, his clothes spoke to more than enough money to find medical help elsewhere.
"Go around to the back gate," she said. "I'll see if Mr. Tillman is willing to speak to you."
Neil groaned his frustration but nodded, fighting back through the crowd to go around to the rear of the building. There was a yard enclosed by a wall that he couldn't see into, but found the gate wasn't locked when he pushed on it. Inside was a yard covered with colourful tiles and lush greenery in wall planters. The yard was occupied by three adventurers with bronze rank auras. A large Leonid man and a small human woman were both hoisting heavily laden barbells in each hand. The third adventurer, Neil recognized. Rufus Ramor was meditating on a woven mat, eyes snapping open as Neil came into the yard.
"Neil Devone," Rufus said. "What brings you here?"
Rufus had administered Neil's field assessment for the Adventure Society. Given Thadwick's reaction, he almost would have preferred a fail to a pass. Neil had no idea what Rufus was doing there, meditating in the courtyard of an old city clinic. A man came out of the building, dressed in clean and simple white linens.
"Who are you, and why do you want to see me so urgently?" the man asked. "I'm more than a little busy right now."
"You're Jory Tullman?"
Neil asked.
"Yes," Jory said irritably. "What do you want?"
"The chief priest of the Gila is coming," Neil said. "He's bringing almost everyone."
"What for?"
Jory asked.
"He thinks your new clinic is a usurpation of the Gila's authority," Neil said. "They're coming here to tear it to the ground."
Chapter 95. Punishment. The glass doors at the front of the clinic opened. Deftly using his aura, Rufus pressured the crowd away without distressing them. He led the way outside, flanked by his adventuring companions, Jory and Neil Devone. They stood in front of the doors and waited. Jory explained to the crowd that there would be a delay with the clinic opening. People started asking him to make exceptions, and Gary stepped out.
"It's an unfortunate situation," he said,
daring anyone to disagree.
"It might be a good idea for everyone to leave and come back later."
"What for?"
some yelled out. The crowd could smell a spectacle.
"That,"
Gary said, pointing an arm along the boulevard. All eyes followed. A multitude of robed clergy made their way down the street. People were scrambling to get out of their path. The crowd outside the clinic moved well away, although not so far that they couldn't see what was happening. Their numbers even grew as others gathered to spectate. At the head of the approaching religious expedition was the chief priest, blasting out his silver rank aura. The group came to a halt in front of the clinic, making an impressive sight. The chief priest was flanked by bronze rankers, with iron rankers and lesser clergy arrayed behind them. The basic robe of the Healer's clergy was simple brown, but these all wore opulent silks of white and gold, with only brown embellishments. Facing the chief priest was Rufus, flanked by Farah, Gary, Jory, and Neil. Panning his eyes across them, the chief priest sneered at Neil before his gaze came to rest on Rufus.
"Rufus Ramore," the chief priest intoned, his sermon-practiced voice reaching all the gathered onlookers. "I'm not sure what brings you here, but is it your intention to stand with heretics?"
"I'm not sure what you mean by that, chief priest," Rufus said.
"This place seeks to set itself up as a temple of healing, taking that which is the right of the healer, and the healer alone."
"I'm not one to speak for the gods," Rufus said. "I will say that Jory here is an alchemist, not a priest. So far as I can tell, he mostly advocates that people read the little labels he puts on medicine bottles. He certainly isn't claiming to be a priest. He's just trying to help people by healing them. Surely your church would take no offense at someone doing precisely what you advocate."
"The only truth in your words," the chief priest announced, "is that it is not yours to speak for our church. Do you think that you, better than I, can interpret the will of the healer?"
"I do," a voice said softly, yet everyone present heard. Carried on a wave of aura that was benevolent yet overwhelming, the two quiet words somehow crashed into the crowd like thunder. Dean Truckle watched Jerick approach the guest house where he and Asano had been talking on the porch. The burly man was the toughest of the thug adventurers Thadwick Mercer took under his auspices, the strongest of Thadwick's lackeys, outside of the noblemen who followed him around in public. Unlike most of them, he was an active adventurer, regularly hunting monsters. He followed Mercer as a way to overcome his own humble beginnings, having no backing of his own. He had earned his essences through years spent in the Greenstone fighting pits.
"Dean, you'll want to stay out of this," Asano said.
"Mr. Asano," Dean warned, "watch out for—"
His warning came too late, as Jerick launched like a ballista bolt, crashing into Asano and through the door of the guest house. The door of woven reeds and bamboo smashed apart at their passage. Dean turned to look inside and saw the pair already moving. They were both on the floor, Jerick seeking to pin Asano down, but all he got was a handful of empty cloak. It vanished in his fingers, revealing Asano was already gone.
"You think you can hide from me?"
Jerick called out as he pushed himself to his feet.
"Actually, yes."
Asano's voice came from deeper in the house. Clemenson's detached guest house was generously sized, with plenty of rooms to hide in. The outer rooms were well lit, but the interior of the brick building had plenty of shadows. Jerick threw a gaze at the door, pointing a finger at Dean.
"Don't even think about running,"
Jerick said, as iron plates started magically appearing around his body to encase him in heavy armor. Once it was in place, he started storming through the building. Dean backed off the porch, winding up next to Clemenson. Clearly the man had rushed off to fetch Jerick the moment Asano had dismissed him. They stood side by side as they listened to the noises coming from inside. Mostly it was loud crashing, Dean easily able to picture Jerick tossing around furniture. It was occasionally punctuated by Jerick shouting.
"You think I won't find you? You can't hide forever! You think a scratch can hurt me? Your hit-and-run tricks won't last you long."
"You should never have gone against Mercer," Clemenson told Dean. "Jerick is going to tear that adventurer apart."
Dean frowned, then went back up to the porch with determined steps. He grabbed his dimensional bag from where he left it by the swing chair. Coming back down, he paused in confusion when he saw Asano standing behind an oblivious Clemenson, even as Jerick's shouts continued to stream from the building. Asano was eating a sandwich. Clemenson saw the odd expression on Dean's face and looked back. Finding Asano right behind him, he stumbled away in surprise.
"Come on, Dean," Asano complained. "What kind of poker face is that?"
Asano's sandwich vanished, and a magical cloak of darkness and stars manifested around him. Clemenson called out to Jerick that Asano was outside, and Jerick's armored form came stomping out the door.
He launched forwards with incredible speed once more, but this time Asano seemed to bounce off, like a scarf tossed into the wind, his cloak fluttering around him as he drifted back to the grass some distance from where Jerick had stopped. Asano held up a hand towards Jerick, chanting a spell.
"Your blood is not yours to keep, but mine on which to feast."
Red light shone from inside Jerick, some of it siphoning off in a trail to be absorbed by Asano's hand. As this was happening, Jerick charged forward. It didn't match the pace of his charge special attack, but was still fast for someone wrapped in that much metal. As he moved, Jerick waved an arm, sending a wave of metal spikes ahead of him. Asano shielded his body with his cloak, but let out a grunt as most of the spikes punched through. Jerick conjured a huge metal pole with a spiked metal sphere on the end, an oversized morning star. He swung it down like a hammer, and Asano danced back lightly from the crude swing, the sphere digging into the ground. He cast another spell.
"Suffer the cost of your transgressions."
Jerick let out a painful yell as he let go of his weapon and staggered before righting himself. Dean couldn't see the results of the spell under the armor, but he'd never actually heard Jerick make a sound of pain before. Jerick walked back to where his weapon was half buried in the earth and yanked it out. Holding it horizontally, in spite of what must have been enormous weight, the sphere shot towards Asano, trailing a chain that linked it to the pole in Jerick's hands. The sphere shot through Asano's cloak, but he was no longer in it. Rising up behind Jerick from his own shadow, Asano jabbed his ornate dagger into a gap at the bottom of Jerick's thick breastplate. Jerick whirled around, but the unarmored Asano was much lighter. Almost comically, he moved to stay behind the spinning Jerick's back. Jerick stopped, and Asano dropped through his shadow, vanishing just as a myriad spikes shot out of Jerick's armor. While he was keeping an eye on the fight, Dean had taken a sack of salt from his dimensional bag and was pouring out a circle on the grass. Clemenson saw what he was doing and tried to interfere, but Dean's forearm grew large, hairy, and clawed, grabbing Clemenson by the throat. He lifted Clemenson into the air.
"I may not be the adventurer they are," Dean said, "but that doesn't mean I'll let the likes of you treat me like I'm nothing."
Dean tossed Clemenson to the ground, where he scrambled away on all fours before getting to his feet at a safe distance.
"Mercer will make you pay for this,"
Clemenson said, all but spitting his words at Dean. Dean looked at Asano dancing around Jerick. Other than the two noblemen who followed Mercer around, all Mercer's lackeys were terrified of Jerick, Dean included. He squared his shoulders, held up his hand, and snapped his fingers. The circle of salt glowed with a green light, then lines within drew out the shape of a pentagram. Runes appeared between the lines, then the lines and symbols turned gold as the circle filled with green light. Out of the light rose a bear-like creature, with savage claws and a body covered in bony protrusions. Dean pointed at Jerick.
"Kill!"
Dean refocused his attention on Jerick. The big man seemed unsteady, but still whirled the sphere on its chain around himself, holding onto the pole at the base. The sphere sailed through the air, shooting out spikes as it did. Asano easily avoided the sphere itself, but the spikes were landing hits. With the strange way the cloak almost floated around him, drifting on the air, it was hard to tell how much damage the cloak and his armor were ameliorating. The Fergax came up behind Jerick, clutching him in a bear hug. If it weren't for the heavy armor, the bony protrusions on the monster's body would have pierced flesh in a half-dozen places. Instead, spikes shot out of the armor, puncturing the Fergax's flesh. It staggered back, and Jerick turned on it as the sphere snaked back down to slam solidly onto the pole. Jerick lifted the pole up and brought it down on the monster. The weapon buried itself in the Fergax, which fell dead from the blow. As it did, Asano chanted out a spell behind Jerick.
"Suffer the cost of your transgressions."
A horrifying groan came out of Jerick, who dropped his weapon and started stumbling around. The plates of his armor fell away, vanishing before they hit the ground. The skin of his arms and face revealed black veins and patches of dead, withered flesh. Thick, dark blood trailed down from his eyes and nose. Dean and Clemenson recoiled at the sight, while Asano moved closer. No longer able to stay upright, Jerick toppled to the ground. Asano held his hand out and channeled another spell.
"Feed me your sins."
Red light again glowed out of Jerek, now massively discolored with blue, purple, and sickly white. All the discoloration flowed out and into Asano's waiting hand as he absorbed the afflictions, leaving only the feeble, flickering red of Jerek's cleansed life force. The black veins visible through his skin had vanished, but Jerek was beyond resuming the fight. "Help me with him," Asano said to Dean, and they pushed him into a sitting position. Asano took out an iron collar and snapped it onto Jerek's neck, before feeding him a potion and lowering him back down. "He'll live," Asano said. "He'll need a few more potions, but he's a tough one."
"Is that a suppression collar?" Dean asked.
"That's right," Asano said. "They're supposed to be restricted, but the bad guys seem to get their hands on them anyway. This one was used on a friend of mine when some cultists tried to sacrifice us. I borrowed it, in case you turned out stroppy."
"You're not going to kill him?"
"That was my inclination," Asano said. "But when a man turns his dog on you, you can't really blame the dog. Is he an adventurer too?"
"Yeah," Dean said.
"Well, not for long, I'm guessing. Sorry about your monster." They looked over at the dead Fergax, Jerek's weapon already vanished from it.
"It's a summon,"
Dean said.
"A new one manifests each time I use it."
"I see," Asano said. He turned to Clemenson, who was cowering off to the side. "Do you think this guy will lend us a cart?" The god appeared in front of Jory's clinic without fanfare. A small, middle-aged man with ordinary features and plain brown robes. Nonetheless, power radiated off him, affecting the crowd gathered on the street. Sicknesses were dispelled and injuries healed. Everyone in front of Jory's clinic fell to their knees as silence washed over the crowded street. In that silence came the clattering of a wooden object falling onto stone, and a single, startled voice.
"My foot grew back!"
The god laughed, looking at the man who spoke out.
"You have a new foot," Hela said. "Please, stand upon it."
A scrawny man stood up in the middle of the crowd, looking immensely nervous.
"You came to this clinic," the god said. "But the alchemist here could not regrow your foot."
"No, your goodness, sir. He helped me with the pain and found someone to make me a wooden foot. It worked pretty well, enough to get me back working at least."
"Did you go to my temple?"
the god asked, as if he didn't know exactly what happened in his holy places.
"They said I didn't have the money to grow a foot back."
"Yes, they did,"
the god said, his gaze turning to the chief priest.
"It is my way to give those who follow me the freedom to do what is right. If doing what is wrong is not truly an option, then doing good isn't a choice. It's just obedience."
The god moved forwards until the kneeling chief priest was looking at the bottom of the god's robes.
"My ways have allowed my followers to go astray in the past, particularly in these outlying regions," the god said. "Rarely, however, has one of my temples fallen so far and so completely. You should not only be ready, but eager to help those in need. Instead, you use the gifts I have given you to garner power and line your pockets."
The god turned to look at the sign for the clinic, then back to the chief priest. As he continued talking, his voice rose to an angry pitch.
"The fact that the proprietor of this establishment was forced to step in where you fell short was miserable enough, but to then turn around and try and stop him from the good works that should have been yours."
The god gestured, and lights started floating up out of the bodies of his assembled clergy. Some were cubes of various colors, others smaller spheres. The people they flew out of collapsed to the ground, moaning in pain. The cubes and spheres continued to float over them, connected by a tendril of light.
Many of you have taken what I offered, yet turned so far from my will that you travel in the other direction. These gifts I take back, for there are none among you worthy. Those who are, you have driven or cast out. Those who looked only to serve, to give help to those who needed it. As we speak, I am bringing the true faithful from distant lands to take your places in my temple. Those who you once shunned will now be welcome.
The god turned to look at Neil Devone, giving him a warm smile.
This includes you, young man. I know you have your struggles, but you bear them as well as any could ask, including me. Let any who would bar you from my holy places again answer to me.
Thank you, Lord, Neil said.
Lord,
came the chief priest's voice, weak and pained.
Mercy!
That you are not shunned from my temples and their services, as you have shunned others, is mercy enough,
Hela said.
You may not serve me again, but we will see to your ills, if you have the coin to pay.
With our essences gone,
the chief priest begged.
We are crippled.
For that, I shall give you no salve, the god said. But you may turn to another.
A second god appeared next to the first, very different from his fellow. His dress was regal, with a long cape, a scepter, and a crown. He was young and handsome, but with a look of disdain and faint cruelty behind the eyes. Not that anyone was looking. His aura washed over the crowd like a wave of fire. The newcomer nodded acknowledgement to the other god.
Healer,
he greeted.
Dominion.
Healer returned cordially, then gestured to his clergy.
These are of no use to me. I think, perhaps, they are more temperamentally suited to your worship.
Dominion crouched in front of the chief priest, rubbing a portion of the priest's robe between his fingers.
Very fine,
he said, standing back up.
You have some seekers of power and privilege here, not your sort at all. I'll take them off your hands if they're willing to submit. I can replace those essences and awakening stones.
Yes, the chief priest exclaimed. I'm willing to serve.
There is no service in my church,
Dominion said harshly.
Choose carefully before you enter into it. I am not healer. There will be no freedom to choose the right path. There will be no freedom at all. Under me, you will obey or suffer, or both, as I choose, because you will not enter my service. You will belong to me.
The now former chief priest gulped, but nodded. The others behind him mostly did the same, although some did not. With a wave of the god's hand, the spheres and cubes floating over those who capitulated shifted in color before returning to their bodies. With another gesture, Dominion summoned an arched gate, through which could be seen the interior of one of his temples.
Go,
he ordered. The former clergy of the healer got up and scrambled through the gate, which closed behind them. Dominion turned to the group gathered in front of the clinic door behind Rufus.
Your friend Jason isn't here,
Dominion said. Rufus, Gary, Farah, Jory, and Neil were all still kneeling, but looked up, startled.
You know Jason?
Rufus asked, uncertainly.
I love that guy,
Dominion said with a grin.
The
the ones who won't kneel are always the most fun. Seeing what it takes to make them capitulate, to put that knee down.
And if he doesn't?
Garry asked. Dominion turned his gaze full bore onto Garry, who trembled under the force of it. Garry defiantly kept his eyes locked on the god, forcing himself onto his feet. Dominion laughed, and the pressure vanished.
That is where monarchs come from,
Dominion said.
I love them most of all. I'll be keeping an eye on you, Gareth Zandier.
Dominion turned to Hela, nodded a farewell, and then vanished as if he had never been there at all. Hela turned to those who had not accepted Dominion's offer. One of them spoke out.
Lord, please allow this humble sinner to seek atonement in your service. I was led astray.
You blame others for your failings?
The god asked.
I was weak, Lord. The failing was mine.
The god looked over the remaining people, then gave a slight nod. Heads bowed, they couldn't see it, but they felt their god's assent.
The path to redemption will not be easy,
Hela said.
A lifetime of humility and service.
The essences and awakening stones floating over them returned to their bodies.
I have restored those powers I gave you in the past, but sealed them away. They will not be available to you, and may never be. This you must accept.
Thank you, Lord,
they chimed out. Hela turned to Neil.
Neil Devone, the god said. Please lead these penitents back to my temple. You will find good people waiting to greet you.
Thank you, Lord,
Neil said, getting to his feet. He was soon leading away Hela's remaining clergymen. The god then turned to Jory.
Stand and see me, Jory Tillman, the god said.
Jory nervously got to his feet.
I am moved by what you have done here,
Hela told him.
If you are willing, I will give this place my blessing and declare it a sanctuary for healing.
That would be amazing,
Jory said. Then his face plummeted.
Lord Healer, there are some things we make here that you might not entirely approve of. I'd stop, but they pay for a lot of the healing research.
Hela chuckled.
I'm not going to begrudge people a little togetherness jelly,
Hela said. Jory let out a nervous noise, then nodded.
Thank you, Lord.
Very good, Hela said. I will have people come to this place for rituals of sanctification. They will be careful not to disrupt your alchemy. And if you are willing, I will maintain a healer here. Your friend had not been as present as in the past, due to his adventuring commitments.
Thank you, Lord, Jory said.
Then we are done here,
Hela said, and turned to the gathered crowd.
Good people, know that this place has my blessing.
A golden wave shone out of him, passing through the crowd and spreading to the city beyond.
All in Old City are healed,
Hela said.
Jory Tillman, you have no need to open your clinic today. Rest, and take people in tomorrow.
Hela vanished, leaving silence in his wake. Some time later, a shell-shocked Jory, Garry, Farah, and Rufus were sharing a drink in the clinic.
I'm going to need new labels,
Jory said absently.
Labels?
Farah asked.
For the rumpy-pumpy good-time ointment,
Jory said.
I'm definitely renaming it Togetherness Jelly.
Chapter 96. You Don't Get a Third. Jason's path back to the city was a long one. The lumber region was on the far side of the delta, and he had Dean alongside him, as well as the suppression-collared and manacled Jerick shuffling behind. Jason considered commandeering a cart from Clemenson, but decided he'd rather walk than deal with the Heidel he would need to pull it. As for Clemenson himself, Jason left him behind. Another person would be unmanageable, and Clemenson wasn't going anywhere. Without his lumber mill, he was nothing. Jerick made some trouble early in the journey. On the first day, he tried to sneak attack Jason from behind, but without his powers, he quickly came to regret it. The first night, he tried to sneak out of the inn, which he came to regret far more. Jason had not used his familiar when fighting Jerick, and Jerick was unaware Jason had left bunches of Team Colin suckered to the wall above every exit. Jason also slowed their progress with his usual routine of healing people in the towns and villages they passed through. He also took some notices from the adventure boards if anything seemed like a threat. Leaving Jerick in the middle of a leech circle, Jason took Dean to show him what actual adventurers did. His Fergax summon was a powerful but solitary threat. Jason quickly identified Dean's problem while on a notice for a small humanoid monster called a Pixelax. Quick creatures with emaciated limbs and long, sharp fingers, they were around a meter tall and appeared in large groups. They swarmed over Dean's summon, which occupied many of them, but others made straight for Dean, who started to panic. Jason swept in to handle them, sword flashing. His afflictions were of little point against the frail monsters, so he didn't bother. Their pointed fingers made little headway against his armor, and they fell to a well-placed sword stroke. Between Jason and the Fergax, the Pixelaxes were made short work of. "Who names these monsters?" Jason wondered aloud as he used crystal wash to clean himself off.
"I don't know," Dean said, still shaken.
"Someone overly enamored with the letter X, apparently. We had a phase like that where I come from." Dean gave Jason a strange look, and Jason realized it probably didn't translate well. "The good news," Jason said, "is that the problem keeping you from being a decent adventurer is quite evident. I know someone at the Adventure Society who can get you assigned to the right contracts to work through it, if that's still what you want." Dean nodded, hesitant, but forcing himself to be determined.
"I can't go back to what I was doing."
"Good man." As they drew closer to the city, Jason was surprised to find Church of the Healer members in multiple towns and villages. It was a pleasant surprise, letting Jason hasten his journey without leaving sick people untreated behind him. Finally, they reached Greenstone and started making their way through Old City. "I have to assume that Clemenson got word ahead thanks to Thadwick," Jason said. "We didn't exactly make great time through the Delta. You have family here in Old City, right?"
"That's right," Dean said. "We build and maintain devices that use water quintessence. It's a decent living, which is how they managed to afford a full set of essences for me."
His head fell.
"I haven't seen them in a while. I let them down pretty badly."
"Take it from someone further away from my family than you can imagine," Jason said. "Don't let pride keep you away. If I leave you and Jerick there until I sort things out, will that be all right? Can you handle him?"
"I can do that," Dean said determinedly. "We may not be one of the big-time families, but our compound is secure enough. Thadwick's people wouldn't move on it unless Thadwick himself was with them, and the whole point of him using us was to keep his hands clean."
Dean guided them through Old City, towards his family's compound. They went through one of the main market districts and into a vast arcade. It had high, vaulted ceilings, stores on either side, and was an obstacle course of stalls and shoppers. That changed as a group of 12 heavily armed thugs started marching down the arcade, pushing people over and even small stalls that were in their path. The arcade cleared quickly as people scattered. Seeing them coming, Jason handed Dean a recording crystal. "Use it," he said. "We'll probably need the evidence later."
"Evidence of what?"
Dean asked, as he threw the crystal up to float over his head. "Stay here and watch everything," Jason said, instead of answering, and walked forwards to meet the group. One of the men was clearly the leader, walking front and center.
"So you're Asano," he said. "I'm not impressed."
Jason panned his gaze over the group. A dozen men, all with iron rank auras. Every aura was uncontrolled, either through lack of training or a lack of aura powers altogether.
"I see some familiar faces," he said.
He spotted Dink, far less brazen than their last encounter. He was hovering at the back with the others who had slunk away after witnessing Dink's beating at Jason's hands.
"I've become a big believer in second chances," Jason said. "This is yours. Leave now."
He pointed out the ones he recognized. "Except for you, 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 and you," he said as he pointed each one out. "You all had your second chances. You don't get a third." The leader laughed.
"Do you not see where we are?" he asked. "These are our streets. See how they all scuttle away like little bugs? That's because they know what's coming. Do you really think you can take us all?"
"Yes," Jason said, his voice dismissive. "I just don't know if I'll be able to leave any of you alive." The leader laughed again.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
"Yes," Jason said. "Either I'm overestimating myself, or I'm not. Decide which you think it is, then act accordingly."
"You're relying on that rigged fight to make people scared of you," the leader said.
Jason looked around. The skylights in the ceiling left plenty of shadowy nooks in the arcade. Even the open space had plenty of stalls and carts to cast shadows. The people were already gone.
"I hope you let me keep doing so," Jason said. "I'd prefer that to having it based on what I do to you."
The leader grinned and stomped the ground with his foot. Stone erupted from the ground, flying at Jason in shards. His ability to aim the power was weak. Most of the shards were intercepted by one of the fruit carts in between them. Gobbets of pulped fruit flew as the stone tore into the cart. Jason was unconcerned by the attack, having already dropped into a shadow on the ground.
"Where'd he go?"
the leader yelled, looking around. Blood from a slashed artery sprayed over them. They looked behind and realized one of their number had already fallen. His body dropped to the ground, falling at the hands of a shadowy figure in their midst. Spattered with the blood of their companion, the thugs were startled into a brief but critical moment of inaction. Jason's wicked-looking red and black dagger didn't stop as he moved like a ghost, finding the back of a neck, a throat, and then burying itself in the side of a head before Jason vanished into the shadow of a dropping corpse. The spooked bottom-feeder adventurers reacted effectively in the few startled moments it took Jason to appear, kill, and vanish. In the aftermath, some of them realized the dead were Dink and the others Jason had pointed out.
"Last chance," Jason's voice came from the darkness. "Leave now," his voice came again, from the opposite direction.
The group looked at each other nervously, and the leader slapped one of them across the head.
"Don't let him get to you. It's just games because he's scared to fight us straight up."
His own voice didn't sound completely convinced, and the others looked at the dead bodies at their feet.
"No way,"
one of them said, and started running. There was a rip of cloth as a huge rat tail emerged from the leader's back. To Jason, watching from the shadows, it looked like the prehensile tail of the rat gorger he had fought. It wrapped around the fleeing man's ankle, tipping him over and dragging him back to the group, where the leader savagely stomped on his head.
"Nobody runs," the leader announced fiercely. "Everyone keep an eye out. He can't pick us off if we see him coming."
They all looked around them, peering into every shadow.
"Don't forget the shadows at your feet," the leader said. "Catch him quick, and you can drop him while he's disoriented from appearing."
As they watched the shadows, they neglected to realize that not every patch of darkness in the tall arcade was at ground level. None of them saw Jason floating down onto the leader until Jason let his mass return, using the weight of the fall to plunge his dagger through the startled man's eye. Their leader slid off Jason's blade and dropped to the ground, dead. The others stared at the shadowy figure standing in front of them like deer in headlights. Even though he was right in front of them, out in the open, none of them made a move. Jason looked down at the man whose head had been stomped on by the now dead leader. He was in a very bad way, but still alive. Jason walked closer to the group, who flinched at his approach. He took a potion from his belt and held it out. "Heal this one and go," he told them, gesturing to the hurt man on the ground. The thugs looked at the potion like it was a venomous snake, but finally one of them reached out to take it. As if that movement was a starter's pistol, the others all ran. The one who took the potion knelt to feed it to his fallen companion. It didn't bring about a full recovery, but with his friend's help, he got to his feet. The thug who had taken the potion from Jason gave him a look of wariness and confusion.
"Thank you," he said, "for the potion."
"You won't thank me if we meet like this again." The pair hurried off, one supporting the other. Soon after, Dean cautiously approached with the recording crystal still over his head. Jerick was walking behind him.
"Give me that,"
Jason said. Dean nervously took down the recording crystal and handed it over. Four of the five dead men on the ground had been beside Dean himself when they first confronted Jason. If Thadwick hadn't needed Dean for his summoning power, and if Jason hadn't needed Dean to use against Thadwick, then Dean himself could have easily been one of those bodies. Jason looked at Jerick, who was also staring down at the bodies.
"You've had your two chances," Jason told him. "If you and I run into each other again after all this is done, I hope you'll be smart enough to run."
Jason looked down at the bodies. "Are these all adventurers?"
"What?"
Dean asked, looking up from the corpses, distracted.
Yes. Those who couldn't pass the assessment themselves, Thadwick had slipped through. That was a while ago, though. It's harder since the new director came in."
Jason shuffled through the pockets of the fallen, eventually digging out their Adventure Society badges. "I'm a little surprised they carried them," Jason said. "It's not like they do any adventuring."
"We all carry them," Dean said. "It gives you some weight to throw around."
Standing up, Jason looked around the arcade. "What's the local civic authority here?"
"The what?"
Dean asked. "Who's in charge here?" Jason said. "Who do we tell about the killings?"
"This is Dorgan's territory," Dean said.
"Dorgan? He's one of those three crime lords, right?"
"The big three," Dean said. "They'd run Old City because people from the island don't care so long as the money keeps coming."
"What about some kind of local government authority?"
"Well, there's the Duke's Guard," Dean said. "But they only come over here if there's some kind of threat to island interests. The big three make sure there isn't."
"Five dead adventurers is a long way from nothing, though," Jason said. "The Adventure Society will be looking into it."
"So what do we do now?" Dean asked.
"Stick to the plan," Jason said. "Get you to your family and I get things settled. This is just one more thing to settle." Chapter 97. Integrity is Sexy. With Dean and Jerick stashed with Dean's family, Jason decided he had time to stop at his lodgings before getting to business. He was weary, heavy with the blood of the men he killed, even after the crystal wash had cleaned it away. He took a long, luxurious shower and, with a fresh change of clothes, went for lunch with Farah, Gary, and Rufus in their suite. Madame Landry sent lunch up in the dumbwaiter, and they went out to the balcony. Since Jason had become an adventurer, they were seeing less of each other, and eating lunch in the sunshine as they looked out over the ocean was something they did whenever they had the chance.
"You missed a lot,"
Farah said to Jason as they sat down.
"Oh?" "Guards showed up at Jory's clinic," Gary said. "It was something to see. Dominion asked after you by name."
"What?" Jason asked, half standing in his chair. "Dominion, as in the god?"
"That's the one," Farah said.
"That's bad," Jason said, settling back down. "That's really bad."
"He seems to like you, if that helps," Farah said.
"No, it does not help," Jason said. "That makes it worse." The others recounted to Jason what took place outside the clinic. "Good for Jory," Jason said. "He deserves recognition for what he does. And that Devone guy, turns out he's all right."
"He's wasted following around that idiot Thadwick," Rufus said.
"You should tell him about the other thing,"
Gary said to Rufus, who looked over at Farah, who shook her head in resignation.
Cowards, she said. Jason, we're going away for a while. There's a big expedition, and we're on it.
Oh?
It finally came out why the Ustai tribe came south. You remember that waterfall that shut off briefly? The monsters you fought?
Of course.
Well, there have been other instances around the desert. Close by, it's only been brief, isolated instances. Up north, it looks like the problem is much worse. Enough that the oases connected to the astral space were no longer able to support all the nomad tribes.
Something is going on with the astral space? Jason asked. That's what we're going to find out, Rufus said, picking up the narrative. We're going to relocate the Ustai back to the north, enter into one of the apertures, and investigate the astral space.
That doesn't sound like a small expedition, Jason said.
It isn't, Rufus said. It's massive. Danielle Geller is leading it, along with a handful of other silver rankers. Dozens of bronze rankers, hundreds of iron, people who haven't been on a contract in years. The chance to explore the desert astral space under the watchful protection of silver rankers. The city's most prominent families are falling over themselves to be involved.
I can imagine, Jason said. Why am I getting a sense of hesitation from you all?
The others looked at each other, all shaking their heads. Finally, Gary groaned capitulation.
You don't get to go, Gary said. This isn't just a matter of you not being invited. You were specifically excluded. Which is a load of crap, if you ask me.
Specifically excluded? Jason said, his voice ramping up.
The others braced for an explosion, but Jason let out a long, calming breath instead.
I guess I can see that, he said.
You can?
Rufus asked, looking at Jason like he was a grenade that unexpectedly didn't explode.
Look, it's no secret that I can be contentious when it comes to the upper classes. I've caused problems before, and I've been rising very high and very fast socially, for someone with no background. I'm guessing this is a test. If I show that I can take this quietly, miss an opportunity without kicking up a stink, then I pass.
Jason turned his attention back to his meal as the others stared at him in silence.
What? He asked them.
We kind of thought you'd have a bigger reaction, Farrah said.
Making a noise in the face of authority is kind of a thing for you, Gary said.
Yes, but I'm coming to realize it doesn't get me anywhere. The snake slithering across the lawn gets shot. The one waiting for the toddler to wander near the tall grass gets fed.
That's a horrifying analogy, but a welcomed, measured response, Rufus said. We might make a decent adventurer out of you yet.
Jason frowned.
Sometimes I wonder about that, he said, his voice heavy. I need your advice on how to handle something.
Of course, Rufus said.
They waited for Jason to speak. His uncharacteristic hesitation was concerning.
I killed 5 adventurers today, Jason said.
What?
Gary asked immediately.
Let him get it out,
Farrah told Gary.
Yes, Rufus said. Start at the beginning.
Jason nodded, absently.
It started with this contract I took at the jobs hall.
Unlike the Geller family, whose seat of power was a sprawling estate in the Delta, the Mercers had built their main residence as a manor on the island. A feat of magical engineering, it was a series of 5 towers set out in a ring, built from a combination of the finest grade of greenstone available and magic-wrought glass. Each tower was 5 stories tall, interconnected by a network of glass walkways. One set of walkways were curved, linking the towers in a circle. Another set of walkways were straight, connecting every second tower in such a way that, seen from above, it would form the shape of a pentagram. Each of the walkways had a clear glass ceiling and color-tinted glass floor, with a different color for each walkway. The sides were open, but with invisible magic barriers in place. The barriers let in fresh air, while shielding from inclement weather, as rare as that was. It also prevented the Mercer children and pets from running off the sides. In the space between the towers was a park, with trees and lawns showered with color as sunlight passed through the walkways above. In the centre of the park was a pond, where waterfowl swam happily about. Children were playing as parents or family servants watched on. They ran around, climbed trees, and tossed torn-up pieces of bread into the water to be gobbled up by ducks. Thalia Mercer was passing through one of the walkways when she felt a familiar aura from the park below. She moved to the side of the walkway to look down, and then vanished, reappearing on the ground. She arrived next to a bench in the park where a man was eating a large sandwich.
"Jason," she said, sitting down next to him. "Your ability to restrain your aura is quite developed for someone of your rank."
"Thank you," he said. "I've been working quite hard at it."
"It shows."
Jason placed his sandwich in his inventory, dabbed at his face with a napkin, then put it away as well. "Lady Mercer," he said, once he was done.
"I've told you, please call me Thalia. I'm afraid you've missed Cassandra. She's out preparing for the big expedition."
"Sadly, this isn't a social visit," Jason said. "I'm here about a contract."
"I wasn't informed of your arrival," Thalia said. "Have you been using my household guard to practice your stealth techniques?"
"Your household guard only has a few bronze rankers," Jason said, "and they all seem to project their auras as imposingly as possible. Not that hard to avoid. I wouldn't be able to get into the buildings unnoticed, though. Too many high-ranking mercers in residence."
"That's the problem with having essence users as guards," Thalia said. "Anyone with the skill to excel is unlikely to work as a guard, while anyone without essences can't be an effective one."
"I imagine you have a few quality staff nestled away. I've recently been learning about the Mercer name's ability to attract people into service."
"Oh?"
"I assume you have a recording crystal projector we can use?"
"Of course," she said. "Please follow me."
"Looks like I have to put both of you down."
Jerick's voice came out of the projection. Jason reached out and tapped the projector, bringing the playback to a stop. They were seated in Thalia's personal study, a recording crystal projector on the table between them. "After that is something of a mess," he said. "A fight from my perspective makes for a disorienting recording. Lots of darkness and teleporting about. Suffice to say, I took the man into custody."
"He's alive?"
"Yes."
"And this witness of yours?"
"Also fine.